Born in the grip of oppression, I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. But when I'm attacked, I protect and defend. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America.
Did you know that federal law says that you must know English in order to become a citizen? So I have a question. Why are our ballots printed in foreign languages? The future of this republic is in the hands of the American voter. And that was a quote from Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was our 34th president. You are listening to Karen Schoen, and this is the Prism of America's Education. Well, as I have told you, I was honored to be asked to participate in the new civic standards in the state of Florida. And while I was doing that, I realized that in order for our future of America, our children, to understand and know our founding documents, they should have a little background of what these documents were about. So I started doing some investigation. And I started doing a deep dive into the creation of our founding documents and why our documents, and I'm referring to the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and even the Federalist and Anti-Federalist Papers, how were these documents formulated? Well, our founders understood the history of government, and they searched people like Socrates and Plato and Aristotle. Now, why would they do that? Why would they bring in such ancient history and bring it forward into what became our great American Republic? Aristotle and Socrates and Plato had a very unique relationship. Socrates was the master, and he really never wrote anything down. Plato was his student, and Plato wrote everything, or almost everything that he wrote, using the words of Socrates. And he would say, "My teacher, my mentor, Socrates said," and then he would give his quote. And Plato is the one that really formulated the concept of the Republic. Aristotle was Plato's student, and he enhanced what Plato said to bring that forward as well. These men were then cited as being the founders of what we know as our political system today. And surprisingly enough, most everything was based on human nature, and they believed that man slash woman would be able to rule themselves basically as long as they understood certain concepts. And that was what they went out to explain. They lived in the early 400s to the early middle 300s, and that was BC. So this was before Christ and before our calendar. What did they believe? Well, Socrates was very heavy on ethics, and he believed that cooperative, argumentative dialogue between individuals based on asking and answering questions to stimulate critical thinking was to draw out ideas and underlying presupposition. He developed what we call today the Socratic method, and that was a method of hypothesis elimination by hearing both sides of an argument. He was very much into the fact that you had to hear both sides in order to be able to formulate a well-rounded decision involving critical thinking. Socrates also said that societies have three parts to their structure, and that the appetite, the spirit, the reasoning structure of the individual soul are what makes up the society today. And he broke those three structures of society into the productive sector, which were your workers. They were the laborers, the carpenters, the plumbers, the masons, the merchants, the farmers, the ranchers. They correspond to the appetite part of the soul. Then he said you had the protective sector, and they were the warriors or the guardians. They were adventurous. They were strong and brave, and they were usually in the armed forces, and they corresponded to the spirit part of the soul. And then he said you had the governing sector, and those were your ruler or philosopher kings. And those who are intelligent, rational, self-controlled, in love with wisdom, well-suited to make decisions for the community, they corresponded to the reason part of the soul. They put all of these teachings together and devised a system that was used to rule Athens for many, many centuries. And as they progressed and was different parts of their teaching came about into what we have today and was used as a model for our republic. They believed in a republic. Socrates believed that instead of rhetoric and persuasion, that reason and wisdom should be used to govern. And he said, and I quote, "Until philosophers rule as kings, or those who are now called kings, and leading men genuinely and adequately philosophize, that it is until political power and philosophy entirely coincide, while the many natures who at present pursue either one exclusively are forcibly prevented from doing so, cities will have no rest from evils, nor do I think will the human race." And what he was saying that is until people can put the idea of power together with philosophy, if you rule on one side, then you will have what is called evil. If you rule with both things in mind, then you will have what is known as what we are supposed to have, which is a representative republic. What Socrates was actually saying was that until people understand that power and philosophy go hand in hand, that you cannot have one without the other, and if you favor one, it will eventually lead to evil because people are inherently evil and those in power tend to take power away from others. Remember, absolute power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The more power a man has, the more corrupted he will become, and especially those who have no moral fiber. So you can't have power without morality, and that was the message that they were trying to convey. Unfortunately, much of it gets lost in the translation, and today what we see are a group of people, i.e. on the Democrat side, who believe that they deserve to have power, and they will do anything humanly possible to make sure that they have that power. What they are actually following is the principle that Aristotle gleaned from the teachings of Plato and Socrates. So while Plato and Socrates focused on knowledge and wisdom and truth, Aristotle flipped that and began to focus on rhetoric. According to Aristotle, you need to know how to persuade people. And there were a group of what they call sophisticates, and they were a series of wandering lecturers. They were skilled in rhetoric, and they would use their ability to argue on behalf of anyone as long as the price was right. Now think about our lobbyists and our opinion hosts, because basically they're doing the same thing. They don't care about objective truth or wisdom, only in convincing others through dubious and questionable means. To Plato, these people, as well as the rhetoric, was something of a disease that infested in the mind of citizens and detracted them from the noble pursuit of philosophy, which was the search of truth. Persuasion, which we now have incorporated into our American politics, is really the umbrella term of influence, beliefs, and intentions, and attitudes, and motivations using the written or spoken word in the form of books, films, photos, anything that becomes a visual concept. And that's why the left uses visual so much, because they believe that visual, that image, will remain and will be able to be used to persuade people into doing things that they want. Unfortunately, their persuasion tactics come more in the term of lies than they do in factual information, because they believe that the power of persuasion overtakes everything, and they will do anything to persuade people to believe what they want them to believe. Aristotle broke this down into three sections, and he called them logos, ethos, and pathos. Now, your logos, or your logo, is your hard, cold fact. And what we have done is taken that and turned that logo into a visual. The words surrounding that logo can change as a country or a company or an individual changes their ideas, but their identifying logo always remains the same. So that gives the person the concept that, oh, if it comes from that logo, then it must be the truth. And that's how you begin to persuade people. Basically, it's the biggest tool for sales and marketing. And this is Sales and Marketing 101 is based on the power of persuasion. Now, the ethos is where you are trying to convince your audience that you are credible. This is your ethics. This is, you would never say anything that wasn't true. And if you get that reputation of being a truth teller, then anytime you put your logo anywhere, people will begin to say, oh, well, that person is telling the truth. It's coming from them, so I must know what it is. The pathos is what you would be describing as the visual appeal, your body language, what you are doing to convince your opponent, convince your audience, convince that you're telling the truth. And you do that usually by visuals. The polar bear comes to mind. Every time they talk about global warming, what do? They show a picture of a polar bear standing on a sheet of ice, and of course the ice is shrinking, so you will get the concept that the polar bear eventually is going to fall into the ocean because their ice is going to melt. Hence, the polar bear will be depleted and will eventually become non-existent. And that is what we have been led to believe. And that was done beautifully by visual aids and, of course, by the film that The Inconvenient Truth from Al Gore. So your pathos appeals to the person's inner soul and what they are thinking, and gets that person to visually understand what the concept is that they're trying to bring forth and enhance upon that concept. And it's easy to see that when we know that, for example, the riots that have been going on are riots, and yet the media are calling them peaceful demonstrations. Why? Because you get the fixed image of peacefulness in your head, and you can't equate that to somebody else telling you, no, they're really rioting. What is never really told enough is that all of these philosophers used mind-enhancing drugs. They were heavy-duty opium users and used all kinds of psychedelics to be able to enhance their thought process. And the later philosophers and psychologists were no different. They used the same types of drugs. Friedrich Nietzsche, who was from 1844 to 1900, studied the philosophers, and he said that there are two states in which man arrives at the rapturous feeling of existence, namely in dreaming and intoxication. He ends his philosophical career by speaking of his inspiration in terms of hearing thunderous voices and stating that he is a disciple of the philosopher Dionysus, the forest god of intoxication. Whether the drug of choice was an opioid, was alcohol-based, it didn't make any difference, because most of the philosophies that we are following today were written by people who were drunk or drug abusers. I strongly believe that that's one of the reasons why we have a drug problem in America today, because the philosophers thought of nothing of using mind-expanding drugs to create their philosophies. Psychedelics are thought of as a mind-expanding drug, so it has commonly been assumed that they work by creating brain activity. But surprisingly, it was found that psilocybin actually caused activity to decrease in areas that have the densest connection with other areas. These hubs constrain our experience of the world and keep it orderly. And we know that deactivating these regions leads to a state in which the world is experienced as strange. What is really happening is that a drug may work one way on one person and may work a totally different way on somebody else. Well, think about what's going on in America with our drug problem. And why was it really never taken care of? If we thought that all the drugs were coming into America and they were just going to the ghetto and the poor areas, think again. They have one stop first, and that is many to Washington, to New York, to the elite, because they think nothing of using these drugs to enhance their experience without any type of understanding of the devastation, nor do they care, because they are only interested in their own experiences. Remember when I said everything is connected, everything has a plan, there is nothing that happens randomly, and all things are based on lies? Well, nothing is more true than let's take a brief look at Afghanistan. Why is America still fighting in Afghanistan? What is the big hold of Afghanistan that Americans have to be there, that were there for a prolonged war? Well, Afghanistan was the largest poppy producer, i.e. street heroin producer, and that was necessary, our elite feel, to keep much of our population in check, because if they can keep them addicted to something, then they won't be looking at something else. The human mind, the human brain, is an amazing thing, but the individual can only think of one thought at a time. You can't do multiple, you can do multiple tasks and you can multitask, but each individual task is only one at a time. So if you're drugged out and you're not thinking clearly, then you're not going to notice the power that is being stripped from you, and many of the insane laws. Just think about what's going on with mask wearing and how people are allowed to riot and loot and murder and nothing happens, but yet if you don't wear a mask in public, you will be arrested. Stay where you are and I will be right back, and then let's take some of these ideas and concepts and see how they relate to what's happening in America today as we are following the teachings of the past.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. This is not a fight of Republican versus Democrat. It's not a fight of rich versus poor, old versus young, man versus woman, gay versus straight. It's not a fight of black lives, blue lives, Hispanic lives, or white lives. This is a battle of good versus evil. It's a fight for the soul of humanity. We are the vision of the voices, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Karen Schoen with the Prism of America's Education. And in the last segment, what I was really explaining to everyone is that our history is rich and goes way, way back, almost, well, more than 2,000 years. And the founders, our founders knew that if they took the best of everything, of all of the different types of governments out there, and put them together, they came up with our Constitution and our Constitutional Republic. And they based their teaching, a lot of it, on Socrates and Plato, who believed that wisdom and truth were the guiding light of knowledge. And that if you have discourse, and that's discussion, between about a truth, you would be able to have conversations about that truth, and you would be able to learn to apply. And that was the whole, their whole concept, is that if once man learns from their experience, once they are taught, and if they are taught in the truth, then they will put the truth together with wisdom and philosophy and politics and be able to govern appropriately. But they also believe that liberty, without any type of hold, without any morality, unabashed liberty will always end in disaster, because unabashed liberty requires no authority. If there's no authority, there's no police. There's no policing. There's no authority figure. And that type of anarchy always leads to tyranny, and that is a crushing government. And that's what Donald Trump understands, and that's what the Democrats are leading us into. And it's so important that we understand our past history, and for that reason, I have asked my good friend, Ricky DeSantis, to join me, because one of the things that I really enjoy doing is talking to him about history. Hello, Ricky, and thank you.
Well, Karen, I want to first and foremost thank you for all you do. Every day you wake up fighting for these freedoms and liberty through morality, emphasizing the key points that are necessary, and also showing the other side's 45 points in achieving communism in the New World Order. So I just want to say thank you for never surrendering and never, ever, ever giving up. And when you talk about Plato and you talk about Socrates and you speak to our founders, you are so correct when you mention that they took a little bit of everything, and they did, because they wanted to perfect something. But it all was benchmarked on morality, individual responsibility and accountability, things such as in the Christian and Judea, religions, the Ten Commandments, and things of this nature. Now, what I'd like to do is you take a graph, and in the middle you have zero, and on the left side you have negative 10, and on the right side you have positive 10. On the positive 10, you have 100% literacy, wisdom, morality, civility, cultures, values, language, and borders, sovereign borders, and respect for those borders and those languages and those cultures and the sovereignty of those republics or nations, as we can call them, approximately 200, I think it's 192 today, that exist in the world. With that said, let us remember that our founders, although they were common people, they were farmers, they were men that worked in the military on behalf of the King of England, fighting in the Indian Wars and fighting in the wars against the French, no matter what they did, they could not have a social event in their house unless it was approved by someone, a lord or somebody of nobility from England. They could not own property. Three things that existed that brought about the Revolutionary War, three major things, was one, freedom of speech, two, the right to bear arms, and three, debt. And it was these three things that, like a pincer movement, by Hitler in World War II, the King of England attempted to thrust upon the colonists in the 13 colonies. He proceeded to remove the currencies and create debt, which is what we're experiencing now. He then went to take the arms, the cannons, and things of that nature, and also limiting speech in the public square, limiting speech as to who could speak. And governors of each colony state were appointed by the King of England, and they had to be people from England. Now, we were fortunate that some of those individuals, once they came here, they became American in their way of thinking. And then fortunately, we did have one or two that actually were American-born. So that sense of freedom and responsibility and individualism, along with those Christian values and morality, and a sense of labor and understanding of these things with currency and debt and freedom and the right to bear arms and independence started to enter into the colonists' minds, only because 99% of colonists were not only literate, they had IQs approaching about 137. This was so because if you thought Shakespeare was hard, pick up a Bible sometime and sit down and start reading a Bible. Okay, if you think Shakespeare's hard, you haven't seen anything yet. And it was because of this that there not only was the ability to read and write, but there was extensive critical and cognitive thinking skills. There was comprehension. There was the ability to think and critically think and to understand and to step back and reason. And that's what brought about the revolution. And that's when, let's refer to it as America, after, of course, Amerigo Vespucci, an Italian, who was a geographer. At times they were debating over whether it would be America from Amerigo or would it be Columbia after Columbus, of course, in 1492. Those two names, and also Ponce de Leon was another name that pops up with regards to the Spaniards and their earlier settlements into the southern part of the United States in Florida and the islands in the Caribbean, as well as the French coming in through Haiti and Louisiana Purchase. But getting back to this, the fact that your populace, and the king knew this, and as a matter of fact, he spoke to it after the treaty in France in 1783 was the fact that they could all read and write. If you look to the British monarch and their military, their navy, their military, and so forth, they were the biggest, most powerful military in the world, but their personnel, their soldiers, were illiterate. The majority of them were young. And when I say young, I mean 12 years old, and they didn't teach them to read or write, and that was intentional, because the more you educate a person, the more they have the ability to think, and the more they have the ability to think, they have the ability to question. And that's what we call wisdom, as you spoke earlier. Now, on the other side of that graph, down at negative 10, where you get into anarchy, tyranny, it's where we are. I'd say we're about negative 8 right now, only because we're holding on. And let us not forget, for the past 30 years, they've worked very hard to get to this negative 8. If we go back 30 years, we get back to an individual by the name of George Bush Sr., who gave a speech in 1991 in the United Nations, speaking to this New World Order, lying to the American people, misleading the American people, when he spoke to a new world and speaking to laws and things like that. The Americans understood that to mean, wow, we are going to finally have a world, because this was the fall of the Berlin Wall in Germany. This was the breaking up of the Soviet Union. The Cold War had been going on ever since World War II. The world breathed a sigh of relief. Finally, everybody in the world will be free. Everybody in the world will have a constitution like us. And that's the way we interpreted that speech. Unbeknownst to us,
we believed that when they said we are going to level the playing field,
yes,
we believe that that meant, oh, isn't that wonderful? Everybody else is going to be brought up to like where America is.
Won't Amen. That? China wouldn't have slave factories.
That's right. And that's what we were led to believe. We're going to level the playing field. Everybody has the same. Until, remember when Barack Obama went to Africa, and he said, I think it was even to
Kenya.
And he said, if you think that you're going to have cars and air conditioning and other things like the Americans have, think again, basically, is what he said. That was not a quote.
Yes. That's bad. That's bad. And that's when they started to make up global warming. First, it was the ozone layer hole, the hole in the ozone layer under Clinton. But that didn't work out because it closed up. So then they did the switch to global warming. That didn't work because the ice masses were increasing and the temperatures actually were going down. So then they incorporated the hockey stick, which was all made up. And now they've moved it to climate change. And
that's why they use it. Because everything that happens, they can blame on the change in the climate and blame it on you. Blame it on us. It's our fault.
Yes.
So the next time they have a snow blizzard up north, tell them to all go outside and breathe, and that should melt the snow.
Global warming, and now they've switched it to climate change. It was all about achieving what was spoken in that speech in 1991, which was a new world order operated by a world government through a United Nations, which is illegal to any country that is a sovereign republic, such as the United States, was supposed to operate under a constitution with a Bill of Rights, according to the Declaration of Independence, where all men and women are created equal. So with this said, its goal was to shut down the economy of the United States, because you will never achieve a new world order as long as there is a sovereign republic known as the United States. And what I want to do, and try to get there quickly, to have you envision, we're on the moon, we're looking at the earth, and it's a sphere. And we're going to look at everything I speak to as a global view, looking down upon it, and seeing that they're little pieces that they are putting into their formula to achieve the ends of controlling the world, bringing in artificial intelligence and robots, depopulating it, and taking control of this earth, which is nothing new. The Greeks tried it. The Romans tried it. The Persians tried it, which is known today as Iran. And also we had it with the British monarch. You had the Dutch monarch before the British monarch. You had the Spanish monarch, and you had Napoleon, the French. You also have the Soviet Union, the 30 years Cold War. We're now dealing with China. So it's in the Roman Empire. Let us not forget the Roman Empire, because we should have learned from that mistake. And it's where a lot of our founders brought about our Constitution.
Right. They took a lot of the things that were done from the representatives and the Senate. And unfortunately, I believe that they're also following the Colosseum. Because
exactly.
All they're doing is using social media as the drug, and the people are, you know, using their controllers, and they're killing each other on the screen. Same thing.
And the sports.
What's going on? Look at the sports, Colosseum.
That's the gladiators.
Yep.
And, you know, it's fantastic that you speak to this, because our U.S. Senate today is not how our founders set it up. The communist, educated with his PhD in communist Prussia, Woodrow Wilson, in his term in president prior to World War I, eliminated the U.S. Senate on how the process and how U.S. senators were elected. U.S. senators were elected by the state legislature of the state that they were to serve as a U.S. senator in. And they could be removed today, tomorrow, if they were not putting forward the needs or the agenda of the state legislature of that state, speaking in this example, say Florida. So the state legislature could eliminate Rubio, you're fired. And then the next day, they could hire a new U.S. senator. Woodrow Wilson, who not only brought us income tax, the Federal Reserve Act, central bankers, and got us tied up in World War I, he also destroyed our U.S. Senate and turned it into the same cabal that was done to the Roman Empire Senate, which then allowed it to become corrupt. You had Caesars, and then you had everything you're living today, the pedophilia, everything, everything. We are reliving it. And it all started with Woodrow Wilson eliminating, one, the process that was put in place by the founders in electing our U.S. senators. After World War II, we then had the country incorporated. And then that's when it moved into the currencies and the fiat currencies. But getting back to all this, each and every thing that I speak to, whether it speaks to COVID, the cognitive dissonance that people are now living on a daily basis ever since 9/11, which was to breed cognitive dissonance and put people in fear and getting them used to things like Emergency Powers Act and government control and martial law and right. things of that nature.
Right, seeing tanks in the street and things like that. Getting everybody
absolutely,
used to it. And I also believe that if you go back and you take a look at some of the old series that are on TV, I've been watching Law and Order. Look at what's going on in the 90s. Look at
yes.
the atmosphere.
Clinton.
Listen to what they're talking about. Not necessarily in the plot, but behind the plot, you'll see the same messaging. Exactly the
yes.
same. Exactly the same words.
You picked the most perfect time period.
Well, that's all. Take a deep breath, and we'll see you back in a few minutes. Thank you all.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa. Award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
What if a new treatment, backed by 17,000 scientific articles, was proven to extend our lifespan, protect against terrible diseases like cancer, heart disease, and dementia, make us more attractive and thinner, feel calmer and happier, and boost energy levels, memory, and performance? What would you pay for even the smallest dose of this treatment? Well, the good news is you don't have to pay anything, because these are just some of the benefits of a full night of quality sleep. If you're one of the millions of Americans who need better quality sleep, the time to change is now. Until now, most sleep aids haven't worked, but a new, easy-to-swallow sleep gel, invented by the leading nutrition company, Healthy Cell, is designed to support all four stages of human sleep to help you fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deep, and wake up refreshed. It's called REM Sleep. To get a free two-night supply of REM Sleep, visit HealthyCell.com/sleep. That's HealthyCell.com/sleep.
Well, just before the break, we have been talking about the influence of the goals of communism on our America. in an effort that I feel is most important, that we understand that what we see going on right now is nothing new. This has been planned and pre-planned and planned over again for the longest time. And any time any of the elite feel that they are being challenged, this is what we get. But I like to go back to the beginning and see what they're actually talking about. And then I go back to my favorite spot, which are their goals of communism, and see how that relates to us today. Well, I picked out a couple of goals because nothing I feel is more timely than having a good discussion on our new Supreme Court justice pick, and that would be Amy Coney Barrett. But let's take a look at the goals so that we kind of know what they're going to be doing to her as they set up this hearing. So goal number 16 says, use technical decisions of the court to weaken basic American institutions by disclaiming their activities. They are already setting up to use the court. Gain controls is 21. Gain controls of key positions on radio, TV, motion pictures, that, and then say that everything that is happening is a violation of civil rights. So we see that going on a continual basis. The messaging is always the same. Goal number 25 says, break down cultural standards of morality by promoting pornography and obscenity in books, magazines, motion pictures, radio, TV, and I will add now in school. Number 27 says, break down and infiltrate the churches and replace revealed religion with social religion. Discredit the Bible, emphasize the need for intellectual maturity, which does not need a religious crutch. Number 28 says, eliminate prayer and any phase of religious expression in our schools on the ground that it violates the principle of separation of church and state. Number 32 says, support any socialist movement to give centralized control over any part of the culture, education, social agencies, welfare programs, mental health clinics, and individuals. And number 40 says, discredit the family as an institution and encourage promiscuity and easy divorce. Now, why did I pick out those goals? Because that's what they are going to be targeting our new Justice Barrett with. And when it comes to religion, I like to bring in my expert, Pastor Rick, because Pastor Rick will bring us into where the church stands on this. So I have asked Pastor Rick to join me today. And Pastor Rick, my question for you to start off with is, do you think that Amy Coney Barrett will be able to separate her religion from her decision-making in our court?
Well, thanks, Karen, and I'm always glad to talk with you. And the short answer to that is I hope she doesn't. I don't really think she can. I don't think anybody can. And I don't think that's the point. I think the thing that ought to get everybody's attention is that so many people who are opposing her nomination are doing it on religious grounds. And I thought I read in the Constitution that we have freedom of religion in this country, and that should apply to a judge as well. And so it's been really annoying to me to hear people attack her because she has a religious belief. Well, we all have a religious belief, even if we say it's no religious belief, but it's not required to have any particular religious belief to be confirmed to the Supreme Court. And in fact, all of the people that are opposing her because they have a different religious belief. So I think we need to cut through all the clutter and clarify what's going on here. By all accounts, the nomination of Judge Barrett reflects the fact that she has a sincerely grounded, felt religious belief. She is a Christian. And all of us should get our heads up and pay attention when she makes that kind of a statement, and then we hear people attacking her because she is a Christian. I know a lot of people are hearing that a number of people are saying, well, she's a Catholic. Well, I think that's just a way for them to divide us and to try to keep us from supporting her. What if she was a Baptist? Okay, she's still a Christian. If she's a Presbyterian, she's still a Christian. Because she's a Catholic, she's still a Christian. And we ought to all realize what they're attacking is not someone who's a Catholic. They're attacking someone who's a Christian. And all of us who come from whatever stream of Christian faith we happen to come from, maybe we're Reformed, maybe we're Methodist, it could go on and on. The key point here is they are attacking her because she has sincerely held Christian beliefs. And that's important to recognize. This other thing related to that is that's important to recognize is that every single person alive has some moral authority in their life that informs their understanding of right and wrong. Every single person does. I often like to ask candidates for office, what moral authority informs your understanding of right from wrong? And many of them, almost every one of them, says the Bible. Well, that's my preference, and I'm glad to hear them say that. But we need to recognize that everybody has some moral authority that informs their understanding of right and wrong. Now, for some politicians, it often seems like it's public opinion. Well, that's their chosen moral authority. I think that's bankrupt. But nonetheless, we need to recognize that everybody has that. And we shouldn't be criticizing her because she has a distinctively held traditional moral authority and, incidentally, a moral authority shared by a majority of Americans.
Yes, and they certainly do not want us to realize that it is shared by a majority of Americans. I remember, and I hope many of you, if you were not born at that time, you should go up, look at some of the things that were said about President Kennedy, because he was the first Catholic president, and they went right after him and right after his religious beliefs as well. But he held his ground, and I know that she will be able to do the same. There are two very important decisions that the left will continue to claim that she will overturn. And let's take a look at these two decisions. The first one is Roe v. Wade. Why, Pastor Rick, would you think that she would overturn that, or do you think that she will? I really don't. I think that what she will do is maybe equate, maybe change, maybe think of something different. But she also believes that once a law is in place, that it's not the court's job to overturn laws, that it is the court's job to rule on what is in front of them at that time. So do you think that she's going to overturn Roe v. Wade?
Well, we all hope that she doesn't try to write law from the bench, which is an accusation that many judges receive, and many of them are guilty of. We want them to rule on whether or not the law is just, whether it passes constitutional muster, those sorts of things. Now, when it comes to things like abortion, I don't know what she'll do in terms of making a ruling. What I hope is that she will have well-founded convictions to value life, and that that will help inform her understanding. The other thing we need to realize is that the Roe v. Wade decision wasn't a law, it was a court decision. And anytime there's a bad court decision, a future court can and should overturn that. We shouldn't keep a bad decision in place just because it's in place. So I expect that, yes, if such an issue comes before the court, she will take a different perspective on that. She will take a look at the original ruling. She will decide whether it was based on sound reasoning, sound understanding of the law, whether it passes our nation's understanding of constitutionality. And then she'll make that decision. Where that will lead us, nobody knows. But what we definitely want is someone who follows the law and follows a good moral conscience informed by our best understanding of that which is right and that which is wrong. And I think she'll do that.
I happen to agree with you. And the key thing that you said was this was not a law. That's really the key. And if the proper approach would be to write a law. But this was not a law.
Well, they don't try to pass a law because they know it's very unpopular to pass such a law. And one of the consequences that may come out of a ruling related to Roe v. Wade is that it will become a state's issue. And so every state then can pass legislation free of any kind of federal encumbrance to handle that issue on their on the state level. And many people think that's the best way to go about it. It certainly doesn't find any place that I can see in the Constitution where there's a right that should give the federal government the privilege of deciding such an issue. That definitely should be left to the states. That makes it very messy, but it also allows many of us to be more involved in the process, and it brings it more into the light of the day if every legislator has to wrestle with that idea, because then they have to go on record of whether they favor it or oppose it. And that's a powerful thing. And many of them don't want to go on record. They want to hide in the weeds on these things, let somebody else deal with it. And if we can get it out in the light of day, I think that will help many things be set right, because many people are absolutely opposed to this idea of abortion on demand and absolutely heartbroken that it continues to this day.
Yes, I want to read the actual decision so that people understand, because what the court did was they divided the pregnancy into three trimesters, and they declared that the choice to end the pregnancy in the first trimester was solely up to the woman. In the second trimester, the government could regulate an abortion, although not ban it, in order to protect the mother's health. And in the third trimester, the state could prohibit an abortion to protect a fetus that could survive on its own outside the womb, except when a woman's health was in danger. And this fits right along with what President Trump just did in his executive order. So the idea that you can have an abortion in the third trimester just because you want to have one was never part of this decision. And whether you agree with the decision or not, the correct way to change it, again, is a law. And just like health is not mandated, health control is not mandated in the Constitution, neither is education. And I agree they should be turned back to the states. And that would make many legislators responsible for their actions. Don't you think, Pastor Rick?
Oh, absolutely. And I think going through this virus challenge, shall we say, has helped us understand why that matters so much. Because, for example, in a state like Florida, we did not have anywhere near the draconian restrictions that some other states are still going through right now. And I think that's an indication that Florida values liberty and the people in charge recognize the limits on government. I think that should help people realize how important it is for the states to be able to make their own decisions, because now I can choose to live in a state that treats me properly, treats me like a citizen with good judgment and the ability to make my own best decisions and not be encumbered by the government's heavy hand telling me what I can and can't do. That's what we used to call liberty. I think that's what we still call liberty. And people need to learn to recognize that so they can require it in their states. Or if the state will not respond properly, then they can move someplace else where they can be free.
Exactly. And it's the same thing whether it has to do with even things like income tax. There are things that are not in the Constitution on purpose, because the state, our founders felt that the government that was closest to the people was the most important government, and actually that was your local or state government. So for those of you that move to a state, it would behoove you to read the constitution of the state that you're going to and make that choice wisely. And that always reminds me when people are moving from a blue state to a red state, and the red state people say, keep your blue state ideas in your home state, and when you come here, follow what we are saying, because that's why we are successful. And that follows right along with this, and it goes right along with what our founders felt. So I believe that something as critical as abortion should be managed and controlled as part of your state health plan. The other issue that they will be looking at, Amy Coney Barrett, to make, I am sure this will come up at her hearing, would be the famous decision of Engle versus Vitale, which was in 1962, and that actually eliminated prayer from school. So what do you think will happen with that decision? Do you think we have a chance to get morality back in school? Because I believe that ever since that decision, morality has taken a nosedive in our country. What do you think, Pastor Rick?
Well, I certainly hope we can bring some sense back to the schools and have a better understanding and education for children to understand right from wrong. That seems to make common sense all the way around. Now, when it comes to the whole business, and people will talk about the separation of church and state, and they'll want to say, well, that has been decided a long time ago, and so we have to keep them apart. Well, I agree in a certain way on that. What the whole idea was from the beginning, and it goes all the way back to Thomas Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptists, was he was assuring them that the government was not going to interfere in their church affairs, that the Constitution actually prohibited the government from telling them what to do as it related to their church and the way it operated. Well, that's what we believe in when it comes to separation of church and state. But always the church needs to be the conscience of the state to help the people that make decisions understand this is right and this is wrong. So when a decision like that comes before a federal judge, appellate court, Supreme Court, then they're faced with the challenge of saying, how does the Constitution address this? And the Constitution very clearly says that there is freedom of religion in this country. And so that whole idea in the Bill of Rights was meant to restrict the government, not the church. So I fully expect that anything like that that would come before her would result in a restriction on government, not a restriction on we the people or our churches.
Thank you, Pastor Rick. Your insight is always wonderful and much appreciated. And let's hope that America does take a right turn and bring morality and sensibility back to both our government and our citizens, because that is surely lacking. Well, folks, it has been a slice of heaven to be able to spend this time with you, and hopefully you will be back again next time as I look forward to talking to you. This has been Karen Schoen, and you've been listening to The Prism of America's Education, brought to you on the America Out Loud Radio Talk Network. Thank you all for listening.
But I'll always stand proud and free. I'm America. Don't tread on.